order. It's 3:20 p.m. on March 16th. With us today are Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Culver, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto is excused, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. We have a pretty full calendar today. First bill is going to be House Bill 188, followed by 337 marijuana taxes, followed by 313 public construction contracts, and last up will be House Bill 263, employer reported workplace death or injuries. Let's see. You it, Kim? Come on up. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. Kim Skipper, staff to Dan Sadler. As the members will recall, we had a brief presentation of this bill on March 9th. The members have a blank CS in their packets. Can I have a motion to adopt the CS as working document?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move CS House Bill 188-29-LS0787 /E.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, the CS before us is the working document. Kim, you have the floor.
Through the chair, my name is Kim Skipper, a staff to Representative Dan Sadler, and my apologies, he's been in House Finance this afternoon.
That's no excuse.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to understand how you want me to proceed. Did you want me to go through what the structural changes in the bill and then read the sectional, or go through the highlights of the sectional?
The former.
The former? Read the sectional?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do a minor structural changes from the original version you had. The main change from the original to the version E is that the Department of Revenue will now run the program versus the Department of Commerce. There's broader language for it to respond to any changes in the federal authorizing law. It allows for the Department of Revenue to contract with other states, and i.e. we mean join a consortium of states to achieve a better economy of scale and share administrative tasks. It allows the Department of Revenue to have an equal vote in the request for proposal process that selects a final financial contractor. And it allows the Department of Revenue to contract with its own financial institution if it chooses to do so and it deems it an economically viable choice. Now I'll go through the sectional. Section 1 cites that this is the ABLE Act Savings Program Act. Section 2 creates a new chapter, 65. It's the Alaska Savings Program for Eligible Individuals. Under that, we have under Section 2 from Section 0665010, its program is authorized, and it authorizes the Department of Revenue to implement and administer the program under the Federal ABLE Act. 020, General Department Duties, that outlines the duties of the department in the implementing and administering the program. 030, Modification of the Program, gives the department authority to modify the program in accordance to any federal law changes. 0665040, Additional Department Powers, allows the department to set fees for the program, program transactions and services, also developing marketing plan to promote the ABLE program. Section 0665050, this is another, what I tagged as a main component. It's contracting authority and procurement exemption. It allows the department to contract with a person to assist in implementing the program, provide services, join other states to obtain or provide services for implementation, join a cooperative effort with other states to provide services for the program that could include investment and record-keeping services. It allows the state to join with other states to allow an Alaska resident to participate in a program in another state under federal authorizing law, and for an outside state to participate in a program in this state if contracting with another state. The procurement code will not apply. Section 0665060, still under Section 2 of the bill, The investment oversight, it allows the department to oversee and approve selection of investment managers and advisors for the program and to oversee all investment disclosures and regulatory filings related to the program investments. 070, financial contractor obligations, it outlines the duties and obligations of the financial contractor. 080, additional audits, it allows the department to order an audit of the contractor's financial operation and position in addition to annual audit if the department has reason to be concerned. 090, contract termination non-renewal, it gives the department the authority to not renew a financial contract. If so, it would take custody of the program accounts and transfer them to another financial contractor that offers similar program accounts. 0665100, eligible individuals, it describes who's eligible for the program. 110, representative of eligible individuals, it describes who may act as a representative for the eligible individual who is a minor or lacks decision-making capacity. 120 is the program account ownership. It states that the owner of the program account is the designated beneficiary. 130, number of the program accounts. It allows only one program account per designated beneficiary under federal authorizing law. 140, the program account application. It outlines department procedures for program account applications and information to be collected in that process. 150, program account establishment fee. It allows the financial contractor to charge a non-refundable to establish program account. That fee to be determined in the contract with the financial contractor. 160, the program account contributions. It outlines how a person can make a contribution. That limit authorized by federal law allows department to reject or withdraw a contribution that exceeds that annual limit or maximum limit established by authorizing law, or if designated beneficiary is not eligible, and the financial contractor must report contributions to the IRS. 0665170, limited investment directions, limits to two the number of times a program account investment can be changed. 180, change of designated beneficiary, allows a designated beneficiary or representative to change beneficiary of an account to another eligible individual in the family. 190, distribution for qualified expenses. It states that the withdrawals from the program accounts may only be used for qualified expenses for the designated beneficiary. 200, the rollover distribution. Subject to federal law governing rollovers, a distribution from a program account can be made to the same designated beneficiary or another eligible individual in the family and the time frame for that to be done. 0665210, statements require that the statements regarding program accounts be issued four times a year at times established by the department and that the program contractor provide related information at the department's request. 220, preparation and filing. In addition to other reports, a financial contractor shall prepare and file statements required under state and federal laws and other agencies. Section 0665230, separate accounting, requires a financial contractor to provide separate accounting for each program account. 240, the annual fee, allows a financial contractor may charge an annual fee for maintenance of a program account. Use as security, prohibits a program account from being used as a security for a loan. 260, exemption from creditor claims, states that a program account is exempt from a claim by a creditor. 270, no state obligation, declares that the program does not create an obligation of the state, department, or any agency to guarantee the return of principal or pay interest on the principal in a program account. Confidentiality, or Section 280, confidentiality, specifies that program account information is confidential. 290, exchange of information, allows the department to exchange information with the Department of Health and Social Services and other state agencies to determine whether an individual is eligible. 300, treatment under means test programs, specifies that the program account amount must be disregarded in determining eligibility for means tested programs. 310, deposit from the permanent fund dividend, it allows deposits to program accounts from the permanent fund dividend. 320, program expense fund, establishes program expense fund and describes its purpose and operation. 330, Medicaid claims, allows that the state may file a claim against the program account of the beneficiary who dies. 340, governing law, establishes federal law as a governing to the extent of any conflict with state law. 350, regulations, requires the department to adopt implementing regulations. 360, there's an annual report. It requires the department to evaluate the program each year and file an annual report on or before the start of each legislative session beginning in 2018. Then there's 0665390 is the definitions. Section 3 creates an exemption for amounts in the program account. Section 4 adds ABLE program account oversight as responsibility of the commissioner. That would be 3630850B. It adds the commissioner of revenue as the oversight as responsibility. Section 5 is 4025120A is amended to create an exemption to public inspection for names, addresses, and other program account identifying information. Section 6, AS45.55.990.32, it excludes the program accounts from the definition of security. Section 7, AS47070555, allows the state to file a claim against the designated beneficiary's program account after the individual dies. Section 8 is transition language, requires the department to file its first report on the program on or before the first day of the second regular session of the 30th Alaska State Legislature 2018. Section 9 is transition, allows the department to adopt regulations, but not before the effective date of the provisions authorizing the Alaska ABLE Savings Account. Section 10, the effective date. Section 9 takes effect immediately. And that is the end of the sectional.
Representative Jones?
Thank you. I have three questions. Through the chair, Ms. Skipper, to begin with, Section
65-180.
180? Yeah. The question is, what... I want this account with guidance and some sort of light conservatorship to be enjoyed by the designated beneficiary. And this says it could be transferred to another individual in the family. Why is that okay?
Through the chair, Rep. Josephson, I would probably have to ask for a lifeline on that question, but I think in this case, some families have more than one person that's disabled, so they can sometimes transfer an account.
And actually, we have two lifelines. We have Stuart Spielman from Autism Speaks, Questions Only, and Monica Windham, Chief of Policy, Division of Public Assistance. Do you have a preference, Kim?
I would, through the chair, I would recommend Stuart Spielman.
Stuart, are you with us again?
Yeah, I'm here. This provision is consistent with federal law that provides for rollovers between affected family members. Kim said, it is often the case that individuals with disabilities have affected family members.
Okay. Next question, if I may.
Question two?
Yes, and I think it'll be my last one. 0665260 states that a program account is exempt from a claim by a creditor. I know that if a minor, a 16-year-old, enters into a contract with a car dealer, the contract is voidable just because they're 16. I don't know what the law is for disabled persons. Can they enter into a contract that is lawful? And if they can, why shouldn't it be attachable if there's some dispute so that the creditor can go after the debtor, who in this case would be a disabled person?
Through the chair, I would probably recommend going to
Stuart Spielman. Hey, you with us again?
I can try to address that. Again, this is consistent with the federal law provision. Under law, an individual with disability is presumed to be competent. I mean, that's where the law works in most states. Unless there is some determination otherwise, an individual can make some decisions. But I think that just as we see in, I'm going to make an analogy to bankruptcy law, there are certain protections, certain money that is considered important to an individual's future and security, and is given some protections. I'm thinking that again under things like bankruptcy law, certain assets like housing may have a different status. That's the answer I would give to your question. It's a good question.
Monica Windham, do you have anything to add on either of the two questions?
Chairman, I do not have anything more to add.
Oh, well, thank you for being a lifeline. Representative Ledoux.
So this is on 0665260. Mm-hmm. So I guess considering the amount of money that can be in one of these accounts, which is up to $400,000, since we're presuming that, and in most cases correctly, that disabled people are able to enter into contracts, I've got a little bit of a problem with that. I mean, $400,000 ain't chump change. That's a significant amount of money. And I understand that in bankruptcy law, for example, there are certain exemptions. But this seems to be a lot bigger exemption than I've seen in, for example, bankruptcy law, which admittedly is not a specialty of mine.
I'll take a swing at it.
Okay.
I think the key to it is up to $400,000. There's probably a whole lot of people that have IRAs or SEPs or 401ks that they're not anywhere close to the cap on it. I've got a feeling that this will be the same case. I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of people that have.
But if I could just follow up on that. I mean, you're probably right about that, that there might not be that many people. But nevertheless, the exemption includes the entire account. So it does include people who have $400,000 there. I mean, I guess I might feel a little bit more comfortable if it were capped at a lower level.
Through the chair, and I believe, this is Kim Skipper with Representative Satter's office, I believe the Stuart Spielman said that this is part of the federal law, so I'm not even sure if a state can actually make
it.
Stuart, we're throwing the ring out again, name an affiliation and take a shot at it.
Yeah, this is Stuart Stone from Autism Speaks. I'm actually trying to pull up the federal statute here, and if you give me a moment, I may be able to refer you to provisions. There is a provision. I'm looking at this. There is a provision. Let's see. Bear with me here. I'm trying to pull up the federal law here on this. It may take me a moment to find what I'm looking for.
I think we'll take a brief of these in case anybody wants to stretch their legs or get up and move around a little bit. Are you with us?
Yes, I am with you. And what I would be happy to do would be to respond to this question, right? I want to make sure I give you correct information and not simply rely on memory.
Perfect. Yeah, and if you could fax that to the office or send it digitally, we'll get it out to the members and out to the public as well. Any further questions for Kim? Representative Hughes.
Thank you. In 06.65.160, it talks about if too much is put in, then the department or the financial contractor can withdraw some, but it doesn't say that, those funds have to be returned to the person. And I would assume they would be returned to the person, but it doesn't state that. And I don't know if that's something that should be included. I'm just pointing that out for the bill sponsor's sake.
Through the chair, Rep. Hughes, and that is correct. The money is returned to the person because you can only have the $14,000 threshold per year. So, but yes, the money is returned. If we have to clarify that, we'll check with
Paul.
Okay. Because it doesn't state it. And then I have another question about 06.65.310, which allows money from permanent fund dividend to be deposited. And I was just wondering why that's even in there, or are we going to have that set up? Is that going to be some option that then becomes part of the permanent fund application? It just seems odd to me that you would say, you know, a particular check that you receive can be put in, or some, you know, anything can be, we can arrange with our banks for automatic deposit. I'm just curious why it's even included, and whether it's going to be part of an option when someone applies for the permanent fund.
Through the chair, Rep. Hughes, yes, originally as we were working through this with the permanent fund, we were hoping, just like the college savings plan, to have a checkoff box. But right now we're not there yet, but we wanted to make sure that option was available for the future. But right now you can do a direct deposit or put any account deposit information on your permanent fund, but we're hoping that to be in the future, to be able to have that as a, you know, constant, you just check it off and it goes.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? With that, is there anybody online that would care to testify on this bill? Is there anybody in this room that hasn't testified yet that would care to testify on this bill? With that, we will close out public testimony. And we're waiting on some written testimony, and we're going to hold the bill over. So thanks again, Kim. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Both Gabrielle Ledoux, Representative Ledoux, and Kalissa Malley.
I think I'm going to let Kalissa take this.
Come on up, Kalissa. And the members have in their packet blank CS. Entertain a motion to adopt the CS as the working document.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, I move CSHB 337 version 29-LS1490 / H as the working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Kalissa, can you walk us through the changes in the CS?
Good afternoon. This is Kalissa Maley, staff to Representative Ledoux. We've got two substantive changes to House Bill 337. The first one is going to be on page 2 of the CS, under section 4361050. Based on the testimony that we heard before, we ordered a CS that would make the $5,000 bonding requirement a cash bond or a surety bond, which was what was requested from the public. The second substantive change is on page 3. It makes this bill take effect immediately, and the idea with that is this bill could be signed into law before licenses for marijuana establishments are actually issued.
What a novel concept.
Yeah, it would avoid some of the inconsistency.
Any questions for Kalissa on the changes? Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Kalissa, there's an article today, I think, in my hometown paper. It says there are 200 applications for commercial marijuana operations. I don't know if that's statewide or that was – can't imagine that's Anchorage. And I'm just wondering, when are those applications supposed to be – sort of accepted or rejected? I'm just looking at the effective date here and wondering about that.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, it's my understanding that the Marijuana Control Board in their June meeting is going to officially issue the licenses, but I'm going to defer to Department of Commerce for confirmation on that.
Well, I'm going to remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS as the working document? CS is adopted. Who wants the first question? Representative Hughes?
I have a question in either for Representative Ledoux or your staff. I've just been thinking about this and thinking this tax for excess marijuana is really more of a penalty or a fine because the person is not commercially registered. And I was just wondering why you chose to call it a tax or as opposed to a penalty fee or something.
Because it's going to be the same amount. Because it's going to be the same amount as if somebody were actually registered. So we just want to make sure that somebody who is not registered doesn't get to undercut legitimate enterprise simply because they're not paying the taxes.
Follow up. But wouldn't the word penalty be more appropriate even if it's the same amount, you know, a penalty equivalent to the tax or something like that? Because this is, I just find the word tax odd.
Well, that's like, you know, the Supreme Court determining whether the Obamacare thing, whether it was a tax or whether it was a penalty. I mean, it ends up in the same way, whether you call it a tax or whether you call it a penalty. It ends up with the same result.
And one more, I've just never heard, I would think of this like a civil penalty, and I've just not heard of a civil tax, that's all. So, thank you.
Any further questions? We had some public testimony last week. With that, I will reopen public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that hasn't testified that would like to on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Nope, nobody online? Wrong one. We have two people online for questions for the committee, Brandon Spanos and Cynthia Franklin. Cynthia is the Director of Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, and Brandon is Department of Revenue Tax Division. Do we have any questions for either one of them? Seeing none, is there anybody else online that would care to testify on this bill? Hearing none, we will close out public testimony. Representative Josephson?
Yes, for further discussion, I have a question for, I guess, Representative Ledoux. On that same section that Representative Hughes asked about, Section 3, if the word not wasn't there, and it said a person who is registered under AS 1738 and who is found to be in possession of marijuana plants in excess of the amount of marijuana plants authorized for personal use, is subject to the tax. I'm just trying to figure out why we need the word not there. Or why it shouldn't say not, registered or unregistered.
Where are we on the?
It's page 2, line 6, and I could very well be missing something simple here. Is it because the presumption is they would be operating?
Because if they are registered, then it's not. Then they're not. It's not the personal use. Doesn't come into play.
They're assumed to be commercially operating.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Just check. Thanks.
Any further questions for either the sponsor or her staff? Seeing none, we will be holding this bill over till the next committee and probably moving it hopefully at that point in time if it's the will of the committee. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Next item on the calendar today is House Bill 313, Public Construction Contracts and Wage Rates. To present that bill will be Conrad Jackson from my office. I'd like to bring everybody up to speed that there is an amendment out to that bill that makes material changes to it that we won't be adopting today because the committee and the public hasn't had 24 hours, but I believe they're out in front and they've been distributed to the LIOs, I believe, haven't they?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they have.
So the bill has changed a bit. Conrad, it's all yours. Walk us through what's going on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. The bill before the committee today, House Bill 313, as you can see, is fairly short. It makes a minor change to the Little Davis-Bacon trigger point. The bill raises that trigger point at which public construction projects have to meet to qualify for prevailing wages. Currently, that threshold sits at $25,000. This legislation would raise that amount to $75,000. And for those that don't know, either in the committee, on the committee, or in the public, a little background of Little Davis-Bacon. I think probably most people know that Little Davis-Bacon was put into place during the Great Depression, and Congress enacted the federal statute, and it prescribed minimum wages, prevailing wages, to be paid to construction workers on federal public work contracts. And then state legislatures have enacted similar laws known as Little Davis-Bacon, and that's what we're dealing with here. Alaska's Little Davis-Bacon Act is found in Title 3605, and that law now applies to public contracts, as I said, over $25,000. Alaska's original $2,000 limit, which was modeled after the federal Davis-Bacon Act, was set in basically in 1935, and that was just recently raised in 2011. The reason for this threshold at all is Little Davis-Bacon projects it's really due to the recognition that some projects are just too small to justify the substantial administrative burden of that are associated with Little Davis-Bacon requirements and compliance. Right now, if your project is under $25,000, that project can be completed without jumping through the hoops of Little Davis-Bacon would entail certified payroll, reporting requirements to the Department of Labor, and actually filing with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. There is, as I said, a substantial burden to these type of projects. The smaller projects, it's I won't get into a percentage, but it is a burden on the small projects. As I said, the $25,000 trigger point. Once you go over that, you do need to register the project, comply with a certified payroll. All of those things. That's just part of doing business. The problem in Alaska is, as we know, we're not privy to a great road system covering the entire state in the lower 48. Access to jobs is much easier. In Alaska, especially the bush, a construction job can easily exceed $25,000 just in the mobilization. The federal limit, again, based on that easy mobilization, it made a little more sense. It also obviously made a little more sense back in 1935. If you look into some of the other states with Little Davis-Bacon thresholds, you'll find that about three-quarters of the states either have no Little Davis-Bacon threshold or they have one much higher than $25,000. In fact, if you take a look through the 19 states that have $25,000 or higher threshold, the average comes out to $140,000 for new construction. So much higher than we are proposing in House Bill 313. Mr. Chairman, I've got some other information here. I'm happy to answer some questions for the committee, but I know we do have some folks that have signed up to testify. The amendment that you mentioned, I won't go into details, but there are some substantial changes, as you noted. The bill, that would change the bill from barely a page to three pages, and would encourage the members to review that. And
could talk briefly about the amendment because we won't be adopting it because we haven't had it out for 24 hours, but it'll make things clearer for not only the people in the room that are going to be testifying, but the people that are probably going to be calling in, that they'll have a clearer idea on the direction that we're going in.
All right, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll just do a very brief, summary of what happens in the amendment. First, and probably something that gets most people's attentions on the top of page 3, we are reducing the proposed limit from $75,000 to $50,000. A number of the other sections on the amendment simply change an account in the general fund from the building safety account to the building safety and wage protection account, and that is created under 4431.025. And if you flip back to page 2, section 7, there is a change down on line 23 that changes the percentage. This starts to get interesting. The percentage of the workers' compensation insurance premiums that are paid to the Division of Insurance but are deposited with the Department of Labor, it changes that percentage to 1.82 to 2.7. And Mr. Chairman, that's a brief synopsis of an amendment that's not before the committee,
but will be on Friday.
Yes, sir.
And with that, who has the first question? Representative Hughes.
Yeah, just wondering, Conrad, thank you for explaining it. The $25,000, when was that set in Alaska, and what inflation-proofed, what would that be today? Do you know?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, that was set by House Bill 155 in, I believe, 2011. It was the chairman's bill and was the first increase to the Little Davis-Bacon threshold since its inception. As to inflation proofing, that was discussed, but I haven't done the numbers to see what it would be.
Actually, I have the number. we took the 1935 or 1938 and inflation proofed it, and it was roughly a little over $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
We took the average of all the states that had it, and it was probably, I think, about $150,000. The highest state in 2010 or 11 was $300,000, and there are a significant number of states that don't have it at all right now, and it's been dropping off on a frequent basis. Mm. Realistically, we wanted to do something that would fit Alaska, and we came up with the 50 or 75. Representative Ledoux.
So what's the inflation on $25,000 for the past it's only been 5 years. Yeah. So what would, if you took $25,000 and put it in, back in 2011 dollars, what would that be now?
I have no idea.
Am I saying this right?
Didn't even look at it. Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Jackson, you talked about the burden being filing, reporting, and certification of payroll. And what I'm wondering is that the true target of the bill, or is it about paying workers less to save school districts and other entities more?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, as I said, the burden is really consists of those items. The ultimate effect of raising that trigger point is more bang for the public construction dollar. By eliminating the certified payroll and those other barriers, it does stretch that dollar a little farther. As a general rule, well, I shouldn't say even a general rule. I'll go back to my history in another life where I actually swung a hammer and built things. And at the time, I was employed in a construction company. The construction company actually bid on and on occasion won public construction projects. And in one instance that I recall, the wage that I was paid as a worker prior to going to work on that specific job was $18 an hour. During the course of that construction project, my wages went up to in excess of $30 plus other fringe benefits. So obviously, everything else being equal, if you're paying a crew of however many people 50% of the wages, that's still at the time, I felt a pretty fair wage. I look at that, the simple math says that the project is going to cost less, stretching that public dollar.
Follow.
Thank you. Because it's commonly understood that over the last 24 months we've dramatically reduced capital budgets. I mean, it seems to me that what you say when you say there's more bang for the public construction dollar is that this bill is partly an outfall of the budget crisis. And if that's true, and it's supposition, you haven't said that, but if that's true, then isn't the further fallout on the worker? I mean, isn't this sort of a de facto tax on the worker?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I've never considered it as a tax.
Representative Liddell.
So we were talking about the most bang for the buck with respect to the public dollar and municipalities and so forth. So I'm wondering, I don't see in here a letter of support from AML. Does AML have a position on this? Are they going to be here testifying one way or the other on this bill?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, my understanding in talking with AML is they don't intend to take a position one way or another on the legislation. They have, I guess, not quite to put words in their mouth, but to kind of paraphrase, they have other fish to fry at this point, and they're going to worry about some other issues. This has not been something that was, prior to introduction of the bill, run by AML to look for their support. It hasn't been on their radar, specifically as far as municipalities, school districts, things like that. We have heard, even since the increase to $25,000, that municipalities are seeing a savings. They are seeing a stretch to that public dollar for construction projects. And we're starting to see some letters of support come in from school districts, municipalities. We have one from the hospital in the chairman's district.
I can answer that. It wasn't on their priority list, and the only thing they're dealing with right now is issues on their priority list. And but we would like to have seen them on them. They were extremely active last time and very grateful. We've been contacted by a number of their members, but it wasn't on their list. In retrospect, if we would have got the word out sooner, we probably would have been on their list. But I can't speak to that. I won't put words in Kathy Wasserman's mouth. But I know how active she was last time. Representative Culver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question that might be the department might need to answer this one. But there's a fee charge for public construction projects to administer certified payrolls. And so I'm wondering what that fee is and if it's a sliding scale based on the size of project. And I believe it was put in place in the Murkowski administration. So do you have any information on that?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, we do have, and I'm sure that members have before them, a copy of the fiscal note. But as far as individual projects.
Right. The policy that's in place. So if a public construction contract is awarded to XYZ company, they have to pay the Department of Labor to administer the certified payroll with a fee structure. And I'm curious as to how much that is, if that's sliding scale, and what that is.
We can get that information for you in the next day.
Yep.
And get it out to all the Culver. Members and the public as well.
Yep. Okay. And Representative Culver, through the chair, there may be someone from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development that could be very specific on whether it is a sliding scale. Currently, the fiscal note shows a loss to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development at $125,000. Based on the current language in the bill, which is a $75,000 threshold.
Okay. Representative Hughes.
Thank you. Just wondering, Conrad, if you might be able to speak to the fact in these other states where it's much higher, 100, 140, 150. What's different in those states, and how were they able to have such a high ceiling? Are they right-to-work states, or?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, you're absolutely correct. There are a number of states that have a substantially higher threshold, and in fact, a number of states have no threshold at all. The highest that I saw that actually has a threshold is $500,000, and that's in the state of Maryland. Others have $400,000, for instance, in Connecticut, $350,000, $250,000. They range all the way down to, again, $2,000. In some cases, I believe I saw something that was, it's just listed as none.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Tammy Wilson, who was extremely helpful on the amendment, everything in the amendment with the exception of the changing of the dollar amount. Do you care to come in? We can find a seat for you.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Hughes.
So, since we don't have very much in the state capital budget, or I don't anticipate we're going to have very much for a while, and most of the state projects are probably both above the 25 and both above the 50 and both above the $75,000 number, how much would you anticipate this would save the state?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, at this point all I can go by is the fiscal note, which actually the Department of Labor, as I said, says that they'll be losing $125,000. With the adoption of the amendment, that number radically changes in the other direction.
But
at this point, obviously, that amendment is not before you. I guess it would depend on the number of projects that are actually above or below that line. The Department of Labor has a better idea of how many projects actually fall into that category. And I believe we've got some folks from the Department of Labor here.
Representative Ledoux, a good portion of it falls into road service areas, either sanding or plowing. I know on the Kenai Peninsula, particularly in the Fairbanks area, where I think Fairbanks has 110 road service area, that's where it has impact.
So that impact would be more on municipalities.
Yeah. Cities and boroughs.
So I guess what I'm trying to figure out in my mind is that here is this bill that's supposed to help the cities and the boroughs, and I'm not seeing anything other than these couple of letters from Kenai, which do not include the Kenai Peninsula Borough. We don't have any letters of support from cities and boroughs, so that's just what I'm just trying to figure out.
They're coming. We've only been working on this bill a couple of weeks. And Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I was just going to make a follow-up comment, actually, to my last question and to launch off what Representative Josephson said, that in essence, you know, he might call this a tax on the worker, but on the other hand, when it's really a tax on the local entities and the cities and boroughs and the school districts when they get less bang for their buck because we have a threshold. And I'm thinking the states where they don't have them, they're able to take, you know, a $200,000 project and get more done with that $200,000 than we can here. So it really becomes, in essence, when we have these arrangements, a tax on the local communities, and if it's a state project, a tax really on the people of Alaska, in essence, if you're, you know, to kind of stretch that metaphor. And so I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, I'll make one. We had 5 years ago, we had one or two union contractors that testified in favor of the bill, and what they said is they were losing money on that size job with all the work that was involved with the certified payroll and everything else. We have not talked to AGC yet, but I would suspect they'll have a position on the bill. But again, the bill's brand new.
Representative Hughes, if I might, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, part of your last question related to basically red states and blue states and why ultimately is where I kind of took that. And I'm looking at my little notes here and looking at the different amounts and that the prevailing wage threshold are set at. And I'm not a red state, blue state scholar. I couldn't tell you each one of them. But I know that 18 states do not have prevailing wage laws, and maybe someone at the table can could say red or blue, left or right, when I read these off. But there are a number of states, and I believe they're across the threshold of political leanings, that do not have prevailing wage.
Thank you.
And in some cases have a very high threshold. And I'm sure in other cases have a very low threshold. It's up to folks like you in those various states that make those determinations.
Well, with that, I think we're going to go into public testimony and begin the process at least. Public testimony is now open. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify? Please join us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And if you could keep it to 3 minutes, we've got a lot of people online that are going to do it. Thank you for joining us today.
Through the chair, Representative Olson, my name is Chris Diamond. I'm here on my own behalf today. I'm a 15-year member of Carpenters Local 1281, and I'm here to speak against House Bill 313 today. House Bill 313 will only benefit unscrupulous contractors who are not willing to pay women and men like myself a fair wage for the highly skilled work that we perform in this great state. By raising the limit of the Little Davis-Bacon Act, you will simply be giving more income to contractors and removing skilled labor from those various projects. When contractors do not have a prevailing wage law ensuring they pay men and women like myself a fair, livable wage, they can then turn to hiring people who are unskilled, desperate, and willing to work for less money. This does our state a disservice on two fronts. First, by hiring cheaper labor, you are getting an unskilled, untrained workforce. That actually raises the cost of construction projects due to cost overruns from shoddy workmanship and errors on the job. You also get an increase in accidents and deaths because their training is not as proficient as what we get. And you get exaggerated maintenance costs further down the line due to the poor work that was done initially by these unskilled workers. Second, by saying to contractors that you can hire anybody willing to do the work at a cheaper price, you are putting men and women like myself out of work by removing biddable projects from honest contractors who are willing and happy to pay highly skilled, highly trained workers like myself. Increasing the Little Davis-Bacon Act to $50,000 will reduce 17% of the jobs that I currently perform. That's a huge cut to myself and my family, as well as the contractors that hire me to work at those smaller projects. Because of the training and the certification I do have, I'm able to earn a fair, livable wage and thus contribute more to my state and my local economies through local taxes and general spending. Cutting wages doesn't save money. That's all this bill will do is cut wages. And I ask that this piece of legislation please die in this room. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Max Milek? Milky. Milky, sorry about that. Thanks for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation from the record. And I think you've been here before.
Yes, I have, Mr. Olson, to the chair.
Welcome back.
Thank you. My name is Max Milky. I'm the business manager for Plumbers and Pipers Local 262 here in Juneau, Alaska, and we cover all Southeast Alaska and represent about 100 members, if I didn't already say that. But this is really not a worker-friendly bill as we see it, even if it's down to 50,000 threshold. I represent a lot of small contractors, which they only have four or five, six guys working at their shops or whatever. And I know back in the 80s, late 80s and early 90s, when things were really tough in the state, we were in a recession here, those little jobs is all we had. You know what I mean? Those $75,000, $50,000, $25,000 projects. And that's what kept us going. That's what kept us, you know, able to make our house payments, you know, go buy groceries, do whatever, those kind of things like that. And you know, right now, today, I would say our contractors probably do 30%. The work that they do are probably $50,000 or less jobs. That's what keeps us going, you know what I'm saying? And with this budget deficit we got going in the state here right now, the next couple of years are going to get tough. And I got to tell you, we have our own training center here, And we've run 30, it might sound like small potatoes, but in the last 12 years, we've run 30 apprentices through our training school and turned them out. And they're working in the communities, paying. They all have houses, have kids in schools, those kind of things. We spend about $300,000 a year right here in Juneau at our training center. We bring kids in from all over Southeast, train them here through our apprenticeship programs. Our international spends $280 million a year. So we turn out some highly skilled workforce is what I'm trying to say here. And we're very highly trained. And I think the key point here was just that, you know, we're talking about these smaller jobs. And that's really important to us. It really is. And that's kind of like our bread and butter. That's how we survive and are able to stay here in Juneau, Alaska, and Petersburg, Ketchikan, Sitka, Wrangell, wherever in here. So I'm not going to get to, I had some other things I was going to say, and I see that the bill is trying to do some other great things for the Department of Labor. I agree with some of that. I think that's great.
Actually, I think all told, we have probably four bills for the Department of Labor right now.
Yeah, no, I see that. And that looks like you guys are trying to do the right thing there, and that's I think that's awesome, you know. So.
And I might add, the commissioner and I are still on speaking terms.
Or still right now today, huh? Yeah, okay. But anyway, I guess I got a whole bunch more stuff here to say, but I think you guys kind of get my point, and I appreciate listening to me, taking the time today. I know you guys got a tough job going here, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for joining us. Mike Sturrock, Island Contractors. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. So I just want to say
Can you state your name and affiliation for
Mike
the record,
Sturrock,
please?
I'm with Island Contractors.
Thanks.
We are a small business. We've been in business for just the last year. I already have to pay. We do certify. Well, I'd say 20% of our work is smaller projects where we do certified payroll. This directly affects what we've got going, but I'm trying to read one of your notes here. The Ministry of Costs. Sorry, one second. I'm trying to find my point. Public agencies revolving. What did I do with it? Well, the certified payroll is already part of what I have to do. It's not that big of a deal to do it on smaller jobs versus the larger projects. We do projects anywhere from $500,000 to $1,000. The smaller projects make no difference. The certified payroll fee, we already have to pay 1% to DOL. I believe somebody asked that earlier. It is currently 1%. There is a cap at $5,000. I think it's great that we're moving 1% more of service fee to DOL. I mean, that's very helpful, but I don't see raising the threshold of the Little Davis-Bacon Act helping the workers or the wages that the guys are currently paid. So,
I believe a portion of the fees that are being transferred are going into enforcement, which
is just fine. That's great. I mean, job site safety is a big deal, and that's...
And again, the people that are primarily doing this are cities and boroughs. And when you live in a small town, like most of us at the table, with the exception of you, he lives in Anchorage, you know who the good ones are and who the bad ones are. And probably because you've been burned once. And we haven't had... So far, when we moved up to $25,000, we've had no complaints from anybody. I heard anecdotally that there was a problem in Valdez several years ago, and the Department of Labor dropped the hammer on the people involved almost immediately, which is the way things are supposed to work. I believe it was a contractor that came up from Seattle, which amazes me that how somebody could come all the way from Seattle for a $25,000 job, but apparently that was the case. But it happened extremely fast, like the system is supposed to work. But that's the only one I've heard of anecdotally. I don't know if that helps you or not.
It doesn't. I mean, we have to do certified payroll on these smaller projects no matter what. I mean, it could be reduced back down to $2,000, and it wouldn't make a difference for what we're doing. So I don't see it saving that much money on my behalf that I would cut any employee's wages for that. So to me, that's I don't support the bill, and just wanted to say that.
No, thank you for taking the time and coming down. Paul Grassi, well, I didn't see you for a while. Come on up, Paul. Tell me how much you like the bill. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Representative, Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Paul Grassi. I'm here on behalf of the Alaska State Pipe Trades and also the iron workers. And basically, I think I'll try to keep this very, very short. We oppose the bill. We oppose the increasing the amount for several reasons. Of course, it's going to be lowering the wages of employees in general. We don't, and also it's going to hurt, it may help the municipalities, but it's going to hurt the local economies because there won't be as much money being spent. Won't be much money being spent because, of course, they're going to get lower wages. But also, and no one's mentioned this so far, it'll also take out the local hire provisions Little Davis-Bacon, which has that. And so, so they could, this will give them the opportunity, employers or contractors the opportunity, if they can't get local people, to hire from out of town, out of state. And so that would just be more money, that would be money coming from the state, from the municipalities, and leaving the state. And we already have a problem with that in general within this state, and I would encourage the legislature not to increase that problem. I think just generally it's bad for the economy, it's bad for working people. With that, I'm open for any questions.
Representative Hughes.
The local hire, does it include community or is it just in state, that piece?
It is in state, but they usually hire for the communities first. And I think there's probably people in the room that could answer that question better, but usually they start with the local communities.
Follow up. So they start just because that makes sense, but in the federal requirement, is there start local community first, or is it in state?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, this is Little Davis-Bacon, so it's a state rule.
That's right.
It's Title 36 of the state law.
Okay, thank you.
Paul has some experience with it. Thanks again, Paul.
Yeah.
Rodney Hessen. Thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Rodney Hessen. I represent the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 1547. I'm also the president of the Juneau Building Trades Council. I'd just like to state that we oppose the bill. I don't feel I need to go over any of the points that have already been mentioned. Thank you for this opportunity.
And for the record, we got Vince's letter, and it's part of the record.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Ray Mitchell in the room for questions only. If anybody has any questions for Gray, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Got off the hook. And we also have Lori Wang, hired Director of the Division of Insurance, for questions only committee. And Nick Persevich? Am I close? I'm challenged by names at times.
No worries.
Thanks for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Kirk Persevich with Carpenters Local 1281, Southeast Representative for Alaska. I also represent for pile drivers and millwrights in the southeast area for when we don't have a representative present. I'm speaking against 313. One of the things that was brought up, there are a few good points. I really like some of the ways that it's helping the Department of Labor. Raising the threshold, unfortunately, does not help any of the workers and does not help any of the actual contractors. It helps the contractors that are trying to break the rules. Trying to get rid of things along the lines of certified payrolls and ways that we can keep track of contractors that are actually abusing the system isn't necessarily a good thing. We have some of the weakest subcontractor language in the 50 states, and to make it easier for them to come and abuse that and raise the threshold and actually have more of an influx of contractors that would abuse the system and not pay their prevailing rate isn't necessarily a good thing. And like I said, trying to get rid of certified payroll with Ledoux's new bill that she's introducing as far as trying to increase the subcontractor, the strength of the subcontractor language, and then us essentially weakening any of the information that we can gather against contractors that are trying to abuse the system wouldn't necessarily help. But I do feel that there is good parts to the bill. 313 does have parts where it is helping the Department of Labor, but raising the threshold from 25,000 to 50,000 does not help. Thank you.
I appreciate you taking the time to join us. Is there anybody else in the room that did not sign up that would care to testify, Don? You going to hold off till next time?
Sure.
Barbara?
I'm reserving my testimony also.
Okay. Seeing none, we're going to go off-site. Dave Reeves, Matsu, are you with us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
Dave Reeves, I'm here representing myself today, speaking on House Bill 313 and specifically in opposition of raising the prevailing wage threshold from 25,000 to 50,000 now I see, for many reasons that have already been stated. Previously, this was at 2,000, the threshold was at $2,000, it was increased to $25,000. Just 5 years ago, which was a 1,250% increase, and now we're talking about a 100% increase again, up to 50,000. I've seen studies that show that the construction costs actually don't go down, that actually they stay the same, and it does lower employee wages. I think it also shows in some studies the construction, it adds to construction workers falling below the poverty line. And there's just a lot of reasons that were already stated previously. I think it's a bad idea to even think about raising that.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to call in, but I'd like to make one comment. You know, the decision to do this was mine. There are a lot of things that I don't like about my job, but I represent everybody in the state. And in this case, I had a number of people come to me to ask that we revisit it. On the flip side, I've spent an incredible amount of time working with the Department of Labor over the years, and either on workers' comp issues, cleaning up workers' comp issues, or other things like the three other bills that we have with them right now. But there's something about me that everybody can hate. I'm also the guy that was involved with Uber using independent contractors and not having workers' comp on their employees, not having any benefits on their employees, and worked with the Department of Labor on that issue. It's been quite an interesting time because I go in different directions, and on this one I've worked with unions over the years, but I have to help, or I have to be responsive to the needs of everybody, and on this one I have no idea which way it's going to go, but we're keeping an open mind, and I'll take the hits, not literally, I hope, but on it. But this was my idea because the people came to me. And with that, we've got Wayne Knudsen, Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Waylon Knudsen. I'm a resident of Palmer. I'm representing myself. I am strongly opposed to this. I'm very disappointed that it's even being talked about right now. Several things have been said already. It was raised in 2011. I believe the original bill for that was $75,000, and this seems like another bite at the apple to me. I've heard a lot of talk about this is for small projects, filling potholes or whatever. $75,000 is a threshold that captures 26% of all state projects let out. So a quarter of all the projects that are let out fall under $75,000. $50,000, I'm not exactly sure how many would fall under that. However, again, I believe that this is just another bite at the apple. You also mentioned out-of-state contractors. The reason the Davis-Bacon Act came about was so that one depressed economy wouldn't affect another economy. This, I believe, will swing the door open for outside contractors. We already battled that as is. The railroad has several contracts right now that were let out to state contractors and a host of others. I'm strongly opposed to this. I would hope that everyone on this committee would vote against this, and this dies right here. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us today. Let's see. Kevin Pomeroy, Fairbanks.
Thank you, Chairman Olson, and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak against House Bill 313. Seems like once again there's an effort to cut construction costs by putting the burden on the backs of hardworking Alaskan craftsmen and women to earn less. Given the numerous independent studies done throughout the nation, the arguments in an old and discredited one that by slashing workers' wages, the states or municipalities could build more schools, remodel more schools with the same amount of money, yada, yada, yada. That if we raise the threshold, we can build more, yada, yada, yada. It's common knowledge that labor accounts for about 18 to 23% of a project cost, yet claims have been made that if we don't have to use any prevailing wages, by golly, we can cut the cost of the projects by 20 to 30%. Well, I'm a product of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and I must have been absent because I wasn't taught that math. There was a study that came out last January from the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, and like the rest of the studies, it found that prevailing wage rates do not raise public construction costs. Instead, the impact of higher wages on cost is compensated by the positive effect on productivity, and that's in addition to the higher quality. Another study funded by the Council for Promoting American Business was conducted by the University of Missouri Department of Economics. They show in study finding number two that when they asked F.W. Dodge Company to provide bids, they gave them bid results of 150,482 construction projects for a period of 7 years in 12 different states. The mean square foot cost of construction with prevailed wages was $150.37 a foot compared to projects without prevailed rates. They came in $160.11 per square foot. They're finding under study three that said they had no difference in the mean square foot cost for elementary and university school construction remodeled when prevailing rates were used. Yet in secondary school construction, the mean square foot cost of construction ended up being $13.35 per square foot cheaper. So we all know that the prevailing wage laws require that construction workers on public projects be paid the wages and benefits that are found by the Department of Labor to be prevailed for similar work in or near the locality in which the construction project is performed. With that comes the provisions recently to require Alaskan hire and utilization of apprentices from a federally registered apprenticeship program. We all know that lowering that threshold is going to eliminate those provisions at a time when the forecasted capital budget, we need those projects. A contractor will bid on projects based on wages, cost of material, estimated number of employees to complete the project on schedule, overhead, profit margin, et cetera. So I don't know why we're always looking first to the workers when we want to cut costs on a project. Keep the threshold where it is currently and allow the workers to continue to bring efficiencies, productivity, and quality. Thank you for the opportunity to weigh in.
Kevin, could I get you to read your read across your name and your affiliation? We didn't get you at the beginning.
Certainly. I'm sorry. Kevin Pomeroy. I'm the business manager of Labor's Local 942. I'm a 45-year resident of Fairbanks, and I also serve as an area road commissioner for the Fairbanks North Star Borough.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Next up is Rocky Knudsen from Kenai. How are you doing, Rocky? Rocky, you're going to have to call back on another line. I think the Kenai LIO is still having some problems. We'll wait for a second for you to call back. No, he's calling from Kenai.
Oh, okay. You got to get some good phone lines down there, Kurt.
Yeah, it's been like this all week. Larry Talbert, are you with us, Larry?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name's Larry Talbert. I'm the business manager for Local 367 Plumbers and Steam Fitters here in Anchorage. And I'd like to go on record as being strongly opposed to House Bill 313. Most of the points I had have already been covered, but I did want to go on record and say that I, for one, do not hate you. On the contrary, I have a lot of respect for you and all the legislators down there in Juneau. You guys are dealing with some difficult issues right now, especially with the budget going through, so again, you guys, we have your back, we respect you, and if we disagree with you at times, we do it respectfully. With that said, I'd like to say that Little Davis Bacon, it guarantees fair competition by establishing a local wage standard that contractors must pay workers on public projects. This provides a level playing field on which contractors can compete for work based on wages that prevail in the area, rather than rewarding the practice of slashing workers' wages in order to win work. Little Davis Bacon also protects our state government from falling victim to fly-by-night cutthroat contractors who perform shoddy work with exploited, low-skilled imported workers. You don't get more bang for your buck from these type of contractors when they do inferior work. As stated earlier, this bill would increase the threshold amount of contract that falls under the rules of Little Davis Bacon, which establishes minimum prevailing wages that apply to construction-related workers. Increasing this threshold further would also lower the wages of these hardworking men and women. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't read about more tax on the working class. They struggle every day to make ends meet, and legislation such as House Bill 313 makes it even more difficult for them to earn a decent wage. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony.
Thank you for joining us today. We're going to try Rocky Knudsen again.
Yeah, hello. This is Rocky Knudsen.
It's a little better, but not much.
This is Rocky Knudsen.
Can you hear me?
Oh, that's much better, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for letting me speak today. I represent myself. It appears to me that this bill would make it easy for an employer to put money in his pocket that should be paid to the employees in benefits or wages to make up for benefits. I think a lot of these small state contracts come from state grants. I don't think there's a lot of competitive bidding. I think the money is there for the workers, for their wages and benefits. I worked in building construction since 1975, and I'm retired. My retirement was not paid by employees or the government. It was paid from my wage package. And I talk to a lot of people now that older than me, as old or older than me, that struggle to make ends meet. Some are drawing Social Security but still need to work, and I hear a lot from them. I guess I'll just have to work till I die. Some people say they just made mistakes, but I think that some just didn't make enough money in their life to live and save for retirement. A person I know and is a general contractor in Whitefish, Montana. I know him really well, and when he makes good profits on jobs, his family goes on vacations, and work. When work's good, they take a lot of vacations. I asked him one day if he ever thought about giving some of that profit back to his employees that made the profit for him. He said, no, you got to keep them hungry so they're better workers. I think that's what this bill's about, keeping the workers hungry so the employers can reap the profits. Thank you.
Thank you again, Rocky. Brandon Calcaterra. Am I close? Brandon?
Yes, I'm here. And yes, you nailed it right on the head.
This is the first time today, thanks. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Okay, good evening. My name is Brandon Calcaterra, and I'm here representing myself. I am a proud Alaskan who has called Anchorage and Eagle River my home for 28 years. I attended grade school here and ultimately received a degree from UAA. I have a wife and three daughters. The reason I live here is because it's a great place to raise a family. The quality of life, I believe, is second to none. The surrounding community consists of great individuals and organizations. I believe I can raise my family here with a certain confidence that our local and state governments will continue to keep the quality of life at a high standard, and this is why I oppose HB 313. When workers are paid the state's prevailed rate, they are 8% more likely to have health insurance. This is a tremendous boost to our community's morale by knowing that your neighbors and their kids are able to get the appropriate treatment if and when it's needed. When workers are paid the state's prevailed rate, they are 4% more likely to have a retirement plan. The sense of security from having a retirement plan certainly eliminates day-to-day stresses for aging families and allows for a much more positive lifestyle to take hold. We know that financial stress is a leading factor in divorces. And when marriages fail, the potential of domestic violence rises, which makes neighborhoods less safe, not to mention the cyclical effect that this has on young children and how they are often influenced by their surroundings. Construction workers in prevailing wage states earn 17% more than their counterparts in states without. I would much rather have my neighbors proud to send their children off to college because they can afford it than to have them earn a lower wage that could result in them relying on public assistance. Everybody suffers when public assistance programs are tapped into. I hope you will also oppose HB 313 and keep Alaska and our communities a place that I have enjoyed calling home. I want my daughters to enjoy the same quality of life that my wife and I have. Thank you for your time.
Thank you again for joining us. Suzanne McCarthy. Suzanne, are you with us?
Yes. Hello. My name is Suzanne McCarthy, and I am here representing Alaska Laborers Training School. We do training for construction. I oppose House Bill 313. I've heard what has been said about the hoops and the paperwork and the certified payroll, but I believe the facts have already been stated that if you really look into it, it's not directly related to the cost of the workers' wages that increases the project cost. Or the cost of the certified payroll, if you take that away and lower wages, that doesn't fix any problem. prevailing wage does not affect wages for construction managers, for the supervisors, for other people that are paid a much higher wage. Their wages remain the same. The bottom line of the construction project doesn't change in any significant way either. The entire burden is on the backs of the young men and women who are actually out there doing the hard work of construction. I believe we've heard about skilled labor. That's what we do, is give them the skills so they can be competitive. They can perform the job and are highly trained and highly qualified, thereby saving project costs and being able to come in under budget instead of over budget. You looked into, I think there's a lot of other cost-saving ways that construction projects can be put in place other than the backs of these workers. It increases local hire. It strengthens the economy. It helps minorities by being able to get jobs and get a fair wage in these areas where these smaller projects are going on. It helps close the income gaps that are out there at low-paying wages, and we've already heard testimony about you pay people, unskilled people, lower wages, and you get what you pay for. You get a less quality product. And I think at this time, with all of our economic stresses, we want to do everything we can to make sure that the economies in these areas, whether they're rural Alaska communities or smaller projects in the cities, in the urban areas, that help strengthen our economies, and that's a win-win situation. These young men and women who are out there working are professionals. Construction is transitory. It's just what the word says. It's temporary work. By being professional at their skills, they should be paid professionally, and that's what the prevailing wage ensures happens. And I think as a state, we certainly should do everything we can to support construction and the hard work that these people who are hired under these wages deserve. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. We're almost out of time. Let's see, Julius Matthew, Eagle River, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm Julius Matthew. I'm representing myself. There are a couple different ways to look at the effects of the workers by raising the threshold and prevailing wage here in the state of Alaska. The effects upon construction workers and their families. More construction workers will depend upon public assistance with no health care or retirement benefits. More construction workers will slip below the poverty line with fewer wages to feed their families. It also has a huge effect upon the morale of the workers, their families, and the way they feel about living in this state. The cost of the economy, considering that we have a $3.8 billion deficit, taking money out of the hands of Alaskans that spend money in this state supporting their families is the wrong thing to do. It's a bad business decision, and it'll be felt statewide by all the businesses that receive that money. The construction aspect is that labor cost is a small portion of the total cost of the project. Reducing the prevailing wage does not bring in more bidding competition, which does reduce the cost of the projects. With higher wages, companies attract higher skilled workers. That equates to higher production on job sites with lower accident rates, keeping the overall cost of the projects down and below estimates. The study was done in January 2015. The adverse economic impact from repeal of the prevailing wage law in West Virginia. Construction workers in states that have a prevailing wage law have a higher average income than do construction workers in states that have never had prevailing wage laws or states that have repealed their prevailing wage laws. The study showed that states with prevailing wage laws from 86 to 2014, workers had an average income of $55,676. A second group of workers in the state that repealed their prevailing wage law had an income of $44,779. A third group of workers in states that never had prevailing wage laws had an average income of
$44,693. Reducing the prevailing wage in the state of Alaska is not in the best interest of Alaska construction workers by reducing their annual income. If you look at the states such as Wisconsin that repealed their prevailing wage law last year, approximately 2,300 construction workers were expected to fall under the official poverty line. 2,400 more are expected to rely on food stamps. 7,700 will likely lose their health insurance coverage, and 3,300 will lose their employer-provided pension plans. When workers lose their pension plans, it may seem like that's saving money or a savings, but actually a huge cost to the state, excuse me, when those workers are depending on that state when they retire. I strongly oppose H. Bill 313. And I'd like to all legislators consider this thing, all the negative aspects of it, and have it die in your committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, we're going to hold public testimony open. I'm sorry we didn't get to the last five or six people, but we'll be hearing public testimony again on Friday. And with that, I am going to hold the bill over and adjourn at 5 o'clock.